Welcome to Work in Progress with Christopher Michelson. This podcast is a work in progress about every working person's work in progress, namely, our quest to be fully human in a working world that all too often makes us feel like machines, in which we often don't even have time to think, and that, in the words of Studs Terkel, too much feels like a Monday through Friday sort of dying. In the spring of 2020, the University of St. Thomas received the initial installments of a pledged gift from the Hoffman Family Foundation and the Toro Company. The gift was given to name the Melrose and the Toro Company Center for Principal Leadership and to support associated academic research, teaching, and outreach activities, including this podcast to which you are listening right now. There are at least two particularly remarkable features of this gift. One is that it was given in honor of Ken Melrose. For many years as a retired CEO from the Toro Company, Ken had shared his gifts with the university in both its classrooms and boardrooms. And his successors as Toro's CEO, who regarded him as a mentor and role model for principled leadership and his brand of servant leadership that once saved Toro from the brink of bankruptcy, chose to honor him first over themselves in the naming of the center. Moreover, the gift arrived after the onset of a global pandemic, more catastrophic than anyone could have imagined. But because the pledge was made before the pandemic, even though nobody could have foreseen how the pandemic would challenge all of us, the gift was given anyway. In these ways, the story of the gift to name the center is a principled leadership story, a commitment to moral principles that endure, even as the circumstances around us challenge and change us. Those challenging and changing circumstances that evolved during the center's first year of existence led our university to shift to remote operations and mostly virtual classrooms. But as in any workplace, to keep things safe and secure, essential workers still had to show up on the front lines to feed our students, be available to them in their dorms and daily lives, and care for them if they got sick. It should be humbling to professors like me and administrators for us to realize that we are not as essential to our institutions as we might have supposed ourselves to be. In the world outside the ivory tower, essential workers showed up in hospitals that served patients suffering from a new and unknown disease, while still finding space and observing safety protocols for patients with other critical ailments. In return, society gave them applause, literally for risking their own lives, to care for those of others. Still early in the pandemic, George Floyd was murdered barely 3 miles from the headquarters of the Melrose Toro Center, sparking protests in Minneapolis and around the world, bringing overdue and necessary attention to systemic racial injustice perpetrated by individuals, the organizations in which we work and gather, and in our social institutions. Late in 2020, a contested presidential election not only brought our political differences into sharper relief, but also, with a change in administrations, reinforced the criticality of military continuity to maintain security for all Americans, even in times of transition and division. In selecting the honorees of the first Melrose Twin Cities Leadership Awards, a distinguished selection committee from multiple walks of Twin Cities life recognized three principled leaders doing their part to confront three of the most significant challenges of this era that we are living through: the pandemic, racial injustice, and reintegrating military personnel into civilian life. In the interviews that follow, I'll be speaking with Caroline Zhao, the chief nursing officer at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, who is accepting the award on behalf of all frontline healthcare workers. I'll also be speaking with Omar Williams, an area business leader with 3M and chair of its African American network, and with Galen Miller, who runs Project Got Your Back to facilitate connections among returning veterans seeking work and well-being at home. Caroline Zhao, welcome to this work in progress, and thank you for accepting the Melrose Twin Cities Principal Leadership Award on behalf of all frontline healthcare workers in Minnesota. I'd also like to say that I'm especially honored to be speaking with you years after first meeting you when you were a new student in St. Thomas's Executive MBA program. You've come a long way since then. Will you tell us about your own career, first as a nurse and now as an administrator?
Absolutely. First of all, I'll start by saying I feel so honored to receive this award on behalf of all the healthcare workers. Indeed, it's been a past 20 months or so for all of us amidst the pandemic. I'll start by sharing a little bit about my career background. So I started as a new nurse at Emory University Hospital back in 2006 after finishing my bachelor's education in nursing. And then I proceeded on to take on various roles in informal leadership roles and also with educating and precepting new nurses into the workforce. A few years later, about 6 years later, I relocated to Minnesota. And I did work a little bit as a travel nurse, so going to different hospital systems and helping them when they needed the help the most. Then I advanced on my career, and I think I want to say at that point, I realized my calling in nursing leadership, and I decided to take the leap of faith and start my journey in a formal nursing leadership role. So I joined Methodist Hospital, which is down in St. Louis Park, as a nurse manager, and I was at Methodist Hospital for the last 9 years prior to being chief nursing officer at Children's Minnesota this year. In my journey as a nurse leader, I did take on several roles as a nurse manager for medical surgical units and then as a nursing director for a cardiac and step-down ICU unit. And in my last 3 years at Methodist, I took on the role of director in hospital nursing operations. And I loved and thrived in that role. And Christopher, I think that's, as I was in my last stages as a nursing director at a unit level, that's when I joined the executive MBA program. And it helped prepare me for the last role as a director of hospital and nursing operations. So in that role, I did a little bit of everything. I partnered with everyone to make sure that we were providing adequate patient care by having enough resources and ensuring that our patients are getting care in a timely manner. I also did a lot of work with launching health equity awareness so that we can close disparities in our racial disparities for patients that we're caring for. And finally, in my last year, I had the pleasure of running the COVID operations as part of the incident command system. I was a operations section chief for Methodist Hospital, and I partnered with 8 hospital systems that are part of health partners to ensure that we provided care to our COVID patients in a timely manner and expanded care as the demand rose. So that's a little bit about me. And then now I'm a chief nursing officer at Children's, been there since March, and I am loving every minute of it. This first year is really a lot about learning the culture and helping support the systems and structures so we can continue to build a better future for kids in our community as the kids experts.
Well, thank you so much for your work. You talk about nurse leadership as your calling, and we think about the work of healthcare at its best as being such giving work. I think we sometimes don't fully understand, what is this workforce we're talking about? I'm wondering if you can paint a picture of all of the essential workers in the healthcare system who have put themselves in peril during the pandemic for the good of others. How many are there? There are nurses, there are others. Who are they?
Yeah, so when you think about a healthcare frontline worker, there are many people that are involved in this work. It starts from the person who greets you on our front desk, who helps you navigate through the hospital. It also continues on to those who clean our beds, our environmental hospital employees, who ensure that you have a clean bed and that you are cared for in a clean environment. And then it goes on to all our nurses, our nursing assistants, our technicians in our radiology departments, and I could go on our doctors, for sure, our core to this work, We also have other roles, respiratory therapist. I think this last year with COVID being a respiratory illness, we've heard a lot more about respiratory therapists, but they have been there all along as frontline workers. Child life specialists in my current organization and many, many others. So there are the teamwork, and it really takes a village to keep healthcare going. And I haven't even mentioned all of them, but that's a little bit of a picture of who you might expect to see as a healthcare worker.
Early in the pandemic, we tended to romanticize the sacrifice of healthcare workers, and we expressed our gratitude in applause, which was well-meant and meaningful, but what else might have helped even more than the symbolic applause?
Very great question. I want to paint a little bit of a picture of what was happening to the healthcare workers as the applause was coming and what stages they were in dealing with what I call the marathon now. This we're in a marathon for this pandemic. So initially, from a healthcare worker perspective, we were alarmed. We're in that stage where we were dealing with, oh my, we have a pandemic. We don't have enough supplies. We don't have treatment for it. And the applauses were coming in, and we felt, you know, more motivated and compelled to rise to the occasion. And then we got to another stage where I call the resistance stage. You have accepted, and we had accepted that, you know, we were in this pandemic for a little longer, and we were getting more determined, but we started going through what we call the COVID surges. Went through the first surge. And during the first surge, we were all excited and motivated to learn, to adopt new care models, be able to do our work differently. We felt the applause loud and clear. And during the second one, I think the public had moved on to some extent. And so the second surge was fierce. And we felt the applause, but there was also a lot of other political things happening. And so the applause was not as the initial stage. But to the healthcare workers, we were at the stage where we were now starting to feel exhausted. And I think that's where the connection between the applause and when we got to that exhaustion stage, the applause wasn't as visible or, you know, heard loudly like we had heard it during the first stages when we were all alarmed and wondering what to do. So I think for the public, painting the picture of this was going to be a marathon and we needed to be applauded and applause during the different phases of stress as we were navigating was probably missed early on. And so you can only imagine what happens now when we are really that exhaustion and overwhelmed stage that I'll talk a little bit about as well, that we're feeling like our work is not appreciated as much. And that only makes the healthcare worker feel even more tired and probably at times less determined to continue providing care in a very stressful time. And we know the pandemic is continuing to linger. So I appreciate the applause. It was helpful. It motivated us to figure out what to do and how to best care for our patients and what to change. But it went away in what I would call rather quickly, given that we're in a marathon.
And we are still in that marathon, and some of the changes that no doubt are demanded by the profession are systemic.
Yes.
What are those systemic changes that need to be made over time?
You know, I could talk about a few changes that need to be made over time. One, disaster preparedness and really thinking about pandemic preparedness. That will take all of us to be able to prepare for that, for the next pandemic or any other disaster we might face in the future. And that requires the entire public, the national public, at the national public level, to be better prepared for the future. I think the other systemic things that I see is really that from a healthcare worker perspective, destigmatizing the ability to seek support when you need it personally. I think about the mental support, the emotional well-being. And lately, especially, we've been dealing with a lot of exhaustion and burnout. And systematically, we need to come up with an approach to help our healthcare workers not get to that stage where they feel burnt out. and are feeling also stigmatized. And the stigma comes from many levels around seeking care because we are seen as heroes, as healthcare workers. And so for a hero to get help that's much needed, it will require normalization of that. You know, everybody gets tired and we all need to depend on each other. And even heroes do require help at certain times. So I think those are the two that I would mention, better preparedness and destigmatizing the heroizing by allowing healthcare workers or helping healthcare workers to feel like they are able to seek help early on and sooner to help combat the burnout, the stress that they may be experiencing in the normal nature of caring for the communities and the patients.
What advice would you give to aspiring healthcare workers? What should they anticipate in the future of the profession?
Great question. So aspiring healthcare workers, I think anticipating that there will be times of great challenge like we have had with the pandemic. The challenges might not be the pandemic level challenges, but challenges enough to disrupt the way we care for our patients. And therefore, anticipating an agile or flexible way of looking at how we provide care and how we are still able to advance the science and art of medicine and healthcare differently, because the healthcare systems themselves, we're really changing those, and the old systems are changing, and we're now moving into new systems that are more agile. So having that mindset of nothing stays the same anymore would be the best advice that I would give to those when getting ready to join the profession and taking care of ourselves. I can't overemphasize that enough, Christopher. Having that wellness toolkit personally is vital, because the work of the healthcare worker is even more challenging and demanding and will continue to be that way into the future. So knowing that you come first as a healthcare worker, as much as we are heroes, starting early on to make sure that we have a wellness plan to take care of ourselves as well, would be another advice that I would give those joining the workforce or the healthcare industry.
Well, Caroline, I would like to thank you for taking the time from your busy professional and personal schedule. There's nothing more important than what you do. So thank you for taking the time to talk with me and to inspire future generations of healthcare workers to take care of themselves so that they can take care of others. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me today, Christopher.
Omar Williams, welcome to this work in progress, and congratulations on the honor of receiving the Melrose Twin Cities Principal Leadership Award. Tell us about yourself.
Well, Christopher, thank you very much for inviting me today. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast, and I am honored to have received this prestigious award recognizing my servant leadership as a chair for the African American Network here at 3M. So where am I originally from? I'm originally from Springfield, Massachusetts, a small city in Western Massachusetts, very diverse community. And, you know, I grew up with a small family, my mother and my sister, and we were very passionate about, you know, being involved in the community, very much involved in our church there. And how do we give back to our community and move it forward? Figuratively, I would say, you know, I'm a person who wants to get involved. I'm very passionate about the areas of giving back that are important to me, such as giving back to our youth, as well as giving back to my community, which has supported me throughout my career. I work for 3M. I'm an area portfolio leader that works for our abrasive systems division. I sell large grinding wheels in the industrial space. Not as sexy as post-it notes, but very exciting technology that we are able to help customers improve their efficiency and improve their manufacturing operation. So I really enjoy what I get to do every day. From the African American Network standpoint, you know, I am the chair of the African American Network in 2021. It's been an honor to be the chair this year. We've had many different things that we have moved forward from an initiative standpoint to support our social justice initiatives as a company. And the African American Network, we've been around for 45 years. We have a focus in three areas, typically individual development, cultural agility, as well as community outreach. So we focus primarily on programs all laddered to those tactics. But this year, one of the things that was really important for us is how do we align those tactics to our social justice initiatives, supporting 3M going forward. So that's just a little bit about the African American Network and a little bit about me.
And did you say, what year did you join 3M, Omar?
So I joined 3M in 2014, right after grad school. I attended Indiana University, Kelley School of Business for my MBA. And I came here directly from Indiana here in the Midwest. So I've now called the Midwest my home.
And were you aware from the beginning that there was an African American network in the company? And, you know, how did events of 2020 in particular change the visibility and role of that network?
You know, that's a really great question. You know, when I first joined 3M, I wasn't aware there was an African American network. In fact, I wasn't even aware of the employee resource group concept. Most companies that I worked for did not have an employee resource group for any affinity group. So it took me a little while to find the network, but when I found it through connecting with other Black professionals at 3M, I felt like it was home. It is truly a family here at 3M who has supported me as a transplant, right? How do I better understand how to navigate a large corporation such as 3M in a safe space? So it was really important for me to be a part of this network. One of the things that I think is most important as we move forward as a network is how do we support 3M social justice initiatives? You know, after George Floyd last year, you know, our corporation, you know, acknowledged that there were systematic issues within our company as well as our community, and we wanted to be a part of that solution. So we made some commitments internally in terms of increasing representation of underrepresented groups, including African Americans and Blacks. And then we also made some commitments around the community, partnering with community leaders to better understand how we can best support, you know, reducing the racial opportunity gaps within our community, leveraging our core competencies as an organization. So we created a 3M platforms of change, made a commitment of $50 million over 5 years, in the Twin Cities, supporting STEM programs for youth, developing, we established a family fund to help address some of the barriers that exist within our community, within the Twin Cities. And then for the African American Network, how can we best support those initiatives that the company has deployed in 2021 and beyond? So, you know, I'm really excited about the things that we have done as a corporation, but more importantly, excited about some of the things that we as an ERN, an Employee Resource Network group, have done to help support those initiatives.
And I understand that participation in the network has grown a lot in the last couple of years.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, last year I was the co-chair of the African American Network. And as I said, there was a renewed focus on DEI, both within the company as well as outside of the company. And naturally, members knew, 3Mers wanted to get involved, right? They wanted to figure out how can they be a part of the change that they wanted to see. And it was important for us to invite those 3Mers to that journey, to be a part of the journey with us. And so through our membership outreach program, reaching out to Black employees outside of the Twin Cities, reaching out to allies outside of the Twin Cities and as well as within the Twin Cities, inviting them to the table, building out programs and initiatives to help support 3M, drive the impact that we wanted to drive forward, because we were a big part of that as an employee resource group. So we have, through this effort, we have nearly doubled our membership in 2021. And I like to hope that we can double our membership again in 2022 as we move forward. It requires a village to have an impact, right? It's not just my shoulders or my leadership that drive these initiatives. It's all the individual members within our network, their collective activism that actually makes an impact within our company as well as within our communities in which we serve. So it's truly a collective effort.
As those of us in the Twin Cities know, the achievement gap, the opportunity gap is significantly larger here than elsewhere in the country. So there's a lot of work to do here locally, but I'm wondering, you know, 3M's a global corporation. Nationally and internationally, how is that work different?
So there are many different programs in which we're involved in. So in 2020, we deployed $1 million of investment to five nonprofits that support Black communities in 2020. In 2021, we deployed another $1 million supporting about five to six nonprofits, some multicultural, some Black and African American. And then we also have programs around STEM. You know, how do we create STEM experiences for young people to help them understand the opportunities within the space of STEM? Whether it be through mentorship program, whether it be through our Best Prep partnership with the St. Paul organization. So all of these touch points and engaging ourselves with our youth in high school, also engaging, supporting youth to get into HBCUs. There's about a $5 million commitment there in terms of offering scholarships. So there are a number of different philanthropic as well as skill-based volunteering opportunities that we've created over the past 2 years. So we as the African American Network are supporting those efforts by guiding the organization on where to make those investments, but then also leveraging our employees to help support some of the skill-based volunteering that we curate through this program. So really excited about some of the things that we're doing now and what we'll do going forward.
Speaking of going forward, what's the future of the network? Will it ever be done with this work? How would you even know if this work were done?
That's a great question. You know, this is truly a journey. As our corporation has acknowledged that we needed to make a change, so has our network. This year, we created our social justice advisory continuity through line, really focus on advising and supporting our social justice initiatives. We established a Social Justice Advisory Council, which includes our Black executives, as well as current and past presidents of the African American Network to help continue to drive these initiatives going forward. We've also refocused on allyship. As we think about our impact, we need to invite allies to the table and to help expand our sphere of influence. So that's truly a journey for us. Is how do we activate our allies to continue to support and champion our mission going forward and support 3M in their social justice initiatives. We're also going through a process of advancing AAN. Part of that initiative is about how can we be more inclusive? African American is a subset of Black. And when we think about this community of African American Network, this is a group of individuals who all have shared and lived experiences, but not all employees. All employees who are Black identify as African American. So we are going through a process of changing our name to be more inclusive and better reflect the value that we bring to the table. And then also thinking about the behaviors that we need to change to be more inclusive and more impactful as an ERN going forward. So that is truly a journey. I would say that's a multi-year journey. And that's something that we have initiated in 2021 and will continue going forward.
And how about the network with other peer corporations? Do you have counterparts in other corporations that have similar networks in their companies?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are nearly 19 Fortune 500 companies here in the Twin Cities, and many of them have Black employee resource groups. And we meet on a quarterly basis with the other Black employee resource groups, sharing best practices, sharing our priorities for replication purposes. How do we leverage our collective voice to advocate for equity in our communities as well as equity within our companies? So we work very, very closely together to support one another. In fact, you know, I think about our last touch point. You know, we connected with Ecolab, and their Black employee resource group is called Eco Essence. And that's what really inspired us as a ERN to really think about how can we develop a name for our network that's more inclusive? But more importantly, you know, one of the things that we observed through our conversations with, you know, with that team is that they had more allies than they did Black employees in their network. So I started to think through, well, how do we best leverage our allies and expand our allyship within our network? So those touch points in replicating best practices are critically important for our Black employee resource groups here in the Twin Cities.
Well, Omar, it is such a pleasure to talk to you, and I want to thank you for the work that you do to advance the cause of social and racial justice in our society, in your company, and around the world. Congratulations.
Thank you, Christopher, and it was a pleasure to be here and have a conversation with you.
Take care.
Thank you. Take care.
I'm here with Galen Miller, Tyler Brockner, Paul Davis, and Austin Tim. And I want to welcome you gentlemen to this work in progress. Congratulations, Galen, on the honor of receiving the Melrose Twin Cities Principal Leadership Award.
Thank you.
You're being recognized for your work connecting military veterans back to civilian life. And we are here with some of those people with whom you've worked. I'm wondering if you can start by introducing yourself, Galen. What do you do for your day job, and how does that work link to the time and effort that you've put into the work that we're here to talk about?
Sure. So my name is Galen Miller. I'm a U.S. Navy Vietnam veteran. I served from 73 to 77 active duty and then the reserves after 77 for another 4 years. And I went in the Navy when I was 17, born and raised in Wayne, Nebraska. And because I needed the service, in my mind, I needed the service to help me grow up and become disciplined and have the GI Bill so I could get my college degree after I got out. So those are all the reasons I went in. I started two businesses, a for-profit and a nonprofit, both for cybersecurity and both for military, to help military get into cybersecurity. And so that's what I've been doing now. And I have a for-profit business called Cyber Intelligence Cybersecurity, which is CICS. And I'm also retired. So I'm kind of, you know, still dabbling in the business world, but also receiving Social Security along with my wife.
Doesn't sound like you're very retired. It sounds like you're keeping pretty busy. So tell us about the challenge that you're trying to confront with your work with military veterans. How many people are returning home each year? What are the obstacles they face? And how are the initiatives that you've developed confronting those obstacles?
This is a great question. The obstacles that they face. So if you can imagine even myself, right? So if I went in the service when I was 17, yes, I did. When I got out, I had no clue what the civilian workforce, how it operated. And so there's guys that have been in the service for 20 plus, even 30 years, they've never had a civilian job in their life. So they get out, they might be on retirement, but they might be 50 years old. So they've got another 15, 20 years to work, and they just don't have any idea how to go about getting a civilian job. And so that's the biggest obstacle. Now, a couple others are when they get out, they miss the camaraderie and the buddy system that they had in the service. That's one thing. And the other one is the purpose and meaning of serving this great country of ours. When you get out, you lose that purpose and meaning. And so that's another one that's a big one. And then the last one is while you're in, you're told when to sleep, when to eat, when to, you know, do everything. And so when you get out, all of a sudden now you're dropped into the civilian world and there's no one telling you what to do. And so it's like, wow, that's a shock to a lot of people's system. Now they have to figure all that out on their own. And when you've been dependent on the military, that's very difficult. Now, the other part of what I do and how I help them get civilian jobs is there's a statistic out there. It's called the hidden job market, that 85% of all jobs never see the internet. They're not posted ever online. So if you're working with just online submission of applications, you're only working with 15%. And the way you unlock that hidden job market is by networking. And if you've been in the service, you don't have a network. I mean, you do have your buddies, and that is valuable because there's a lot of people that have gotten out before you that would love to have you call them and say, hey, can you help me? I'm looking for a job. Or can you help me figure out how to expand my network, right? So there's a book that I have them read that's called The 20-Minute Networking Meeting by Nathan Perez. And it teaches you how to conduct an informational interview. And by meeting with executives of companies, bada boom, bada bing, they're the ones that know about all the 85% of the other jobs that are out there. And so that then gives these individuals an opportunity to get hired. When you become a civilian, you don't want to lose that meaningful lifestyle that you've been living. So it's important to find meaning in the work that you do. Another statistic, according to Gallup, 85% of the people hate going to work every day because they get drained. By the time they get home, they're spent. Well, that's because they're not doing something they enjoy. If you do something that you're passionate about, you get energy from doing it. And that's what I have found about helping veterans is I get energy. You wake me up at 2 o'clock in the morning, tell me I'm going to go help a veteran. Boom, I'm there. I don't care about sleeping. I care about eating. I'm going to go do that because that's where I get energy from.
I'm hearing that energy in your voice. I'm also hearing the connection between what you learned, the skills you developed when you were in the military, and what you brought to the marketplace.
Right.
Part of the reason that you invited your three friends to join you on this podcast is to hear from the stories of these guys. So I'm wondering if we can start with you, Tyler. Tell us, where were you deployed, when, and what skills did you develop and bring back to the market?
So I was in the United States Army. I did Army ROTC at St. John's University. So I did that. I did communications as well. I did IT management. And I did that for 4 years. I deployed to Afghanistan, to Eastern Europe, and other places in Asia. Had a really, you know, awesome experience in the Army and met some tremendous people from throughout the world. And I connected with Galen after returning back to the United States after spending a gap year in Australia due to COVID-19. We picked up and decided, we being my wife and I, to come back home to Minnesota. And it was the first time that, you know, I had attempted to get a job outside of the Army. And of course, I've had side jobs and things, you know, in high school and such, but not a career. And so the purpose, direction, motivation, that's what Galen was talking about, that the Army provided, or like camaraderie that fellow people in the Army provided for me, was lacking.
Tyler, you talked about how Galen helped you to network, but I don't think I heard how you actually found Galen.
So I connected with Galen through one of my college roommates, also at ROTC. He found this guy on LinkedIn and he was like, hey, this guy says he wants to help veterans. Not really sure what's up with that. I know you're coming back to the United States. Maybe you could meet with him and grab coffee or something. And that was just that. It was kind of on a whim. It was a bit odd to meet someone who was so energetic as Galen and so outgoing and wanting to be so selfless.
Paul, tell us how you met Galen and what's your story?
Yeah, so Galen, as I have come to find out, knows pretty much everyone in Minnesota. We were just talking about LinkedIn, and the very first thing that I ever do when I receive a LinkedIn request is see if they know Galen Miller, and I think about 75% of them do, which means then, of course, I accept them as a friend. But I met Galen Miller, so I got out of the Marine Corps 2018, started working with Boston Scientific, and became involved with the Veterans Employee Resource Group there. And ended up talking with another fellow Marine looking for a job. We were talking about Boston Scientific roles, how he could become involved, what he could bring to the company, vice versa. And by the end of our discussion, he said, you know, there's a guy you need to meet. His name's Galen Miller. And he gave me his phone number, contacted Galen. I think we met the next day. Galen and I worked together almost every single day. With Project Got Your Back, and work to continue doing the same thing to help veterans. So that was, boy, a year and a half, almost 2 years ago now.
So, Paul, if I understand you correctly, you are now working with Galen to help others through Project Got Your Back.
That's right. Yep. So we met together, and he was looking at, you know, can I help Paul? And I'm looking at, who is Galen Miller? He was able to give me some really good pointers. And then before you know it, we became, I guess, compadres in helping veterans. Although I've got a long, long ways to go before I can catch up to his stats. So,
Well, based on your recommendations so far, I just send a connection request to Galen through LinkedIn. So we'll see if he accepts it.
Well, I'll accept you now if you know Galen. So,
Austin, tell us your story and how it connects to Galen Miller.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was an engineer officer in the Army. I just got out in April, so about 6-7 months ago. And I actually met Galen while I was in Afghanistan last year. So I spent 9 months in Helmand Province for pretty much all of 2020. And I got connected through Galen, actually through a veteran job fair. I was networking with a company there, and the guy's like, well, sorry, I can't help you, but I know a guy who can. And he gave me Galen's name and number. So I actually had to call Galen on a landline because, you know, I couldn't call him on my cell phone when I was in Afghanistan. So I called Galen on this random landline number, and he took it from there. He showed me the 20-minute networking book that he referenced earlier. We talked about what type of ideal job description, different environments that I would be able to kind of represent what I was doing in the military, and then kind of transfer that over into the civilian world. So we were able to work while I was in Afghanistan together for a few months. And then when I got back last year, we were able to connect actually in person, and he ended up helping me get connected with Paul Davis, and I ended up landing a job at Boston Scientific. And then since then, been able to grow my network through Galen and then get involved with Project Got Your Back as a navigator to help pay it forward with other veterans. So cannot say enough good things about Galen and what he's been able to provide me and my family.
I'm wondering if you guys can say a little bit about what makes work meaningful to you, both on the military side and the civilian side.
So I'd like to kick it off. Meaningful work will be something that if you repeat on a regular basis, you will get energy from and you will enjoy doing. You could put it in terms of a passion. If you're passionate about something, it's meaningful. You could also put it in terms of how you're wired, because everybody gets different energy from doing different things. And so, you know, I enjoy when that transition occurs. You know, for the gentlemen that are on the call, when they were in transition, prior to that, they were following orders. It has nothing to do with doing what you enjoy doing, right? So you've been following orders. So once you come out of the service and you no longer are getting orders to follow, you got to figure out yourself what gives you energy. And you may not be doing what gives you energy. So you got, when you figure that out, you got to shift and think about, well, I need to do something that gives me energy. And so that's where the purposefulness and meaningfulness comes in. But it's also for a company that's doing meaningful things. So I also try to layer in making sure that they pick the top five companies that they think they would enjoy working for because of what it is they'll be doing for that company, what that company does.
Yeah, so for me, when I was in the Marine Corps, I have a passion for the Marine Corps and for leadership. And I think what it really comes down to, for me, is the impact I can have on people's lives. And being a Marine Corps officer, I was able to have a big impact on many lives, both the individual Marines that I led and knew, and also, of course, the value that we bring to the mission and to our nation. And leaving that for a lot of people is really, really challenging. And trying to fill that void with something else is also really challenging. It's something you can't measure. It's hard to put into words, but that was a big part of what I was looking for when I got out. Again, it's tough to equate to what you did in the military. But now working where I do, Boston Scientific, where we save lives through our medical devices, and the culture there and everything, it makes a big difference. It absolutely does. And it's going to differ person to person too, of course.
I guess I would echo a lot of the same stuff that Paul had talked about, having that bigger purpose, especially like working in the medical device. You obviously are serving the patients. You're looking to improve their life. So similar to the military, of having that greater purpose and having a reason to get up and work towards improving somebody else's life is pretty meaningful. And you can do that for as long as you can. So it's not going to end anytime soon, which is great.
Can you say more about that, you know, got your back mentality?
So Project Got Your Back has been around for about 12 years. And initially, their objective was to help business owners that are veterans to be more successful as business owners. That transitioned into, where are all the veteran organizations in the state of Minnesota that have the objective of helping anyone that's had the uniform? So Project Got Your Back evolved into an organization that was trying to just understand where all these organizations are. Who are they? How would you categorize them? What do they do for veterans? And what was heard during that time was every organization has one thing in common. They can't find enough veterans to help. So there's this big gap. Well, we're out here, we're trying to help veterans, but we can't find them. So that was on one side. And then on the other side is all the veterans that we help. If you ask them to name 10 organizations that are here to support them, they will struggle. They may be able to mention two or three. There's over 300 in the state of Minnesota. So then there's the gap on the veteran side that doesn't know where the organizations are at. And so Project Got Your Back in the last 6 months has pivoted to now bringing on individuals that are military veterans themselves to be navigators, to know about these organizations. And then we pair them with a transitioning military person we call clients. So the client and the navigator are the nucleus of the effort. And they develop a relationship for a year where the navigator understands the challenges that the client is going through. And then with this plethora of organizations, refers them out using an application called Unite Us to refer them out. And then Unite Us has a platform where all these organizations build a profile and they commit to responding, which is extremely important if you're going to have a referral. You know, it's our reputation that's on the line when someone doesn't get back to the veteran that we're trying to help. So that's an important aspect of it. And now we've got around 50 clients and navigators working together to change lives. And that's the premise of what I've been doing for the last 35 years. So now I've got an extension of all these navigators that I'm helping learn what it's like to be a servant leader with ethics and morals and selflessness. It's all part and parcel to being effective. You have to have empathy. Like Paul was saying earlier, you have to have that drive to help others. It's not about me, it's about them. And what can I do to help them without any intention of anything returning back to me again? That's where the selfless part. And that's a servant leader.
Yeah, and Chris, I think for a lot of people, there's a drive to join the military for service of your country. And then once you're actually in it, once you're in combat, you're in a firefight, all of a sudden it becomes about the guy or gal to your left and right. It's about the individual who's there, who's actually serving with you. That's where the meaningful, I think the transition to meaningful work happens, where maybe it started off this way. It still is. It's not gone away. Service to your country, but really it's about the individual that you are helping or helping to stay, you know, keep alive or whatever the case may be.
Can you have that kind of caring and camaraderie in a civilian job?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think you can. I think that it's harder to find because the stakes are not often as high. But I think that there are certainly organizations and there are certainly professions out there that are similar, yes.
It's critical when you're in the civilian world to replace that genuine, heartfelt brotherhood, sisterhood that we experience in the military. And so one way to do that, and I use a phrase, the best therapy for a veteran is to help another veteran. And that just carries true through our Navigator program. And it's because of what you experienced in the service and now know what camaraderie is when you get in the civilian world, finding your brothers and sisters and finding out how you can help them really, really adds meaning and purpose to your life.
Austin, you were going to say something as well.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar to Paul too. It can definitely happen in the civilian world, but one thing about the military that I really liked is that relationship is built so much quicker and faster because the stakes are higher. And in the civilian world, like Paul said, the stakes aren't as high. So you might connect with somebody initially, but it might take quite a bit longer to develop that bond and that relationship with them, because you're not spending 24 hours a day with somebody at 3 a.m. with somebody. You really find out who somebody is. You can talk about the most random things and learn about that person more than you ever could, you know, during a normal workday. So that's one thing for sure, that the one thing in the military that you gain that relationship much faster.
Tyler, we're recording this on a Friday morning. What would you be doing if you weren't on this podcast right now? And how do you get meaning from it?
Chris, I would be remotely collaborating with a team at US Bank. I work in IT initiatives. And so I think when Galen asked me the question of what are important factors to you and a future organization, and this is past Tyler when he's transitioning, that was something that was important to me. It wasn't a flashy office. It wasn't the nice furnishings or something. It was the ability to work with other competent individuals on a team of motivated people. And I think that's something that came directly from my experience in the Army, was working with people that were motivated and wanting to be on that team. And so that is what I would be doing every day with my great team at the bank. So,
do you think that the military prepared you for teamwork in a way that other walks of life don't prepare you?
I think it definitely provides the opportunity for you to connect with different people, not only in the military, but your partner allied forces, especially when you're serving abroad. It's no longer just the United States doing operations. It's the French, it's the Germans, it's local nationals, it's so many different cultures. And teamwork in a nuclear sense with our own community and people that you're more familiar with is one thing, but being part of a greater team comprised of different cultures and expectations, that is a true skill of working as a team.
This is going to sound a little corny, but it occurs to me that the work that Project Got Your Back does is the work of a team. You know, it's got to involve, of course, the work of the nonprofits. It's got to involve the work of the employers. And of course, it involves the work of the military. If you guys had your wish, how would that teamwork improve in order to make the path smoother in that transition that you're all focused on from military to civilian life?
So moving parts with Project Got Your Back is, about 5 years ago, when I was working at Target, I put together the Twin Cities Military Network. And that consists of all 24 corporate Fortune 500 companies that have headquarters here in the Twin Cities that have an employee resource group of veterans. Okay, so Target, 3M, Ecolab, Boston Scientific, they all have somewhere between 500 and 2,000 individuals that meet together on a monthly basis to talk about how to improve veteran hiring and veteran retention. Those are big things for large corporations. Well, my measurement is, do you have a veteran in recruiting that's responsible for hiring veterans? It's really simple. Most corporations, they talk the talk and don't walk the walk. If you're serious about hiring veterans, hire a veteran and have them responsible for hiring veterans, because they can understand the language, they can read the resume, they get the mentality. All of it's the package is there. There's a couple standout organizations. Cargill has a veteran hiring veterans. US Bank has several veterans responsible for hiring veterans. I won't mention the ones that don't, but you know, they just don't have the commitment. And so one of the things that's very important for transitioning military is to have the receiver, when you are involved in a organization, understand you. And that's hard. It's someone who hasn't gone through the experience of being in the service, and like Paul was mentioning, being shot at, you're not gonna understand that person to the depth that someone else next to you who has served and gone through that experience.
Yeah, and there's misnomers out there too, right? You've got on both sides. You've got the misnomer that every veteran has PTSD and has their damaged goods and they have baggage, and that's just not true. Certainly some do. Certainly some carry the wounds of war and have different things that need to be dealt with. But most veterans or many veterans when they come out, they're just looking to find their way in life still. They're looking to navigate, and it's really hard when you get out to navigate the companies and the interview process and the resources, the VA. and that's one thing that's the main thing that we bring as an organization with Project Got Your Back is that ability to navigate. So whether you do need the help with PTSD or say homelessness or employment or finding a vehicle, there are, like Galen said, there's over 300 organizations just in Minnesota alone. That's not including the VA. That's not including your CVSOs. There is an ocean of resources out there. And Chris, when you ask what do we want, how would we want this to get better, is for people to know about these resources because they're there. They're wanting to help people.
Well, you should be proud of the work that you're doing and the work that you did. And I would like to thank you for it and congratulate you on this award for the efforts that you are making to smooth that transition.
What we're doing with Project Got Your Back is not possible without Galen Miller. He brings the heart to the organization. He brings his years of experience and knowledge, and we are so fortunate to have him. And I just can't think of a better recipient for an award like this than my friend Galen.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for that beautiful tribute and for sharing your stories, gentlemen. Take care.
Work in Progress with Christopher Michelson is produced by the Melrose and the Toro Company Center for Principled Leadership at the University of St. Thomas.